Welcome to Global Leader Radio, sponsored by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, discussing ideas that matter with people who care. Now here's your host, Director of Business Development and Instructor of Management for the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, Alvin Miles.
Well, happy Tuesday and welcome to episode 41 of Global Leader Radio. The purpose of our show is to engage in conversations that highlight our guests, educate our learning community, and add value to all who seek to optimize their leadership skills and overall leadership acumen. So we achieve this purpose by providing our learning community with key takeaways, including resources and advice that have led to the personal and professional success of our guests. And we've got two good ones today. 600 years ago, the Dalai Lama said, "Share your knowledge. It's a way to achieve immortality." And our guests are here to do exactly that for us and with us today. So given that thought, we welcome Mark Bell and Kevin Johnson. Dr. Mark R. Bell is the Chief Strategy and Chief Administrative Officer of the Brand Bank, and he was formerly Chief Operating Officer for the sister company at Brands Properties, a real estate and development firm. So in these capacities, he has led a number of transactions, including one noted as the Deal of the Decade by Atlanta Business Chronicle. So you're going to have to give us some insight on that one. So Dr. Bell is currently a research fellow and adjunct professor of finance at Emory University's Center for Alternative Investments, where he teaches on a range of frontier investments. So Dr. Bell has a distinguished background as a director of strategy and a private equity investor, and a stint at McKinsey & Company, where he was involved in the energy industry. Say that three times really quickly. So he received a Marshall Scholarship to study at Oxford University, where he received his doctorate and master's degree, and was both a Jowett Senior Scholar and the Vice Chancellor Scholar. So he's the author of a scholarly monograph, several peer-reviewed articles, and many book chapters. So he is very involved in the community and sits on a couple of distinguished boards. Kevin Johnson is our second guest, and he is president of Johnson Media Incorporated. And as a serial entrepreneur, he has over 13 years of experience leading his multi-million dollar marketing and communications company that serves many of the most notable Fortune 100 businesses. Now, having 13 years of experience is normally not a big deal, but when you're 33, it tends to be a big deal. So that's why we have him here as well. So as an innovative leader, he has appeared on ABC's Good Morning America, Oprah Radio, and in Forbes, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal, and he's a frequent guest on CNN. Kevin is also the best-selling author of The Entrepreneur Mind, 100 Essential Benefits, Characteristics, and Habits of Elite Entrepreneurs. He lives in Atlanta, Georgia, with his wife and son. And given that overview, we welcome both Mark and Kevin to today's edition of Global Leader Radio. So how are you gentlemen doing?
We're doing great. I'm doing great. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks.
Yeah, you look like you're locked and loaded today, man.
Oh, we're ready.
We're going to have some fun.
Yes.
So Mark, we'll begin with you. So how are you? Other than that, everything's good?
Everything is going well. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, fantastic. And so please tell us a little bit about your background, starting with your birthplace and your home, and a bit about your work experience, and take us up to the present.
Sure. I think you covered a lot of the highlights, but I was born in California, and but as much as anybody is, kind of an Atlanta native, went to high school here, then went back to California for Stanford before going to Oxford to do a PhD, and was a professor there for a little bit before going into the business world. Was at McKinsey, like you said, where I worked with a number of nonprofits, and then was on Wall Street for a while before coming here to Atlanta and working with a family and working with the Brand Bank.
Very good, very good. So, tell us a little bit about what happened after that, because you are somewhere in there. You moved into academia. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I also teach at Emory today. I teach for 6 years. I've been teaching at Emory. And taught for 2 years at Oxford. At Oxford, taught religion, and at Emory, teach business.
Okay.
So two things that aren't always connected in most people's mind, but a lot of the investments I've made need prayer. So it's worked out to be two good qualities to have.
Well, that is too much fun. And so it is the academia piece of it that brought us together more than any other, because as I recall, our good friend Michael J. Coles is the one that referred you to us, and we wanted to have you on. But my understanding is that you actually have taught in his program, perhaps?
I have and really enjoyed teaching the KSU students I've taught. Taught there really about banking. Michael serves on the board of the Brand Bank and has since I recapitalized that bank 3 years ago with a series of private equity investors. So Michael's been a great influence there, and obviously, you know, has been a tremendous, tremendous leader in American business, but also has been very helpful and understands the importance of a community bank and the role that that plays in the community. And so is willing to serve helping us run our ship.
Well, good. I appreciate you for taking a moment and telling us a little bit about that. So at this current time, you're doing both. You're doing, you're playing in the academic world as well as the world of industry, correct?
Yeah, and for me, that's part of my thinking about leadership and service. That the academic part, as all of us in this room know, is so highly lucrative that it's hard to pass up. But
wink.
I say that my service at Emory is truly that. It's service, and I've had so many people. I think I left the academy when I was about 30. I stayed in school as long as someone else was willing to pay for it, and. Just had so many fantastic professors who invested in me that the opportunity to teach at Emory and work with about 100 students a year, I take a very different approach than a lot of folks in that coming out of Oxford and coming out of a tutorial background where you meet with your professor for an hour once a week and that is your class. Versus the American system where you have 400 people and you kind of get an hour. I try to meet with each of my students twice during the course of the semester for an hour and talk about them, their background. And that's probably the most rewarding part because, you know, a lot of students go through all of undergrad or graduate school and really don't have anyone who sits down and says, I'm interested in you as a person.
Okay.
And so for me, a lot of Emory is an opportunity to serve, and my day job is at the bank, and the leadership component really is around developing interactions with people and investing in people and the rewards that has.
Fantastic. So that's how you are able to bridge the focus on theory in academia with the focus on applicability in industry.
That's right.
Okay. So what about your interest in religion and business? Tell us a little bit about what you're doing in those two areas or what you have done in the religion area.
Well, my interest in religion is really around why religion or interest in exploring the premise of does religion cause violence?
Okay.
And we can maybe that might be a separate show, but that's really been my largest interest. But my experience has been and you know, there's a book called Business as Calling, which to me has been very influential in that it helped me understand that the business life is really one that's as much a calling as other lives that are focused more on nonprofit or health and human services. And I think that business leaders who can understand the calling nature of their profession are actually a lot of times much more successful. Because it's not, at the end of the day, necessarily about the money or other aspects of it. It's about creating value, opportunity, about doing things that are valued by your society and your group. And so, to me, you know, we laughed at the beginning, but the religion and business aren't really as antithetical as a lot of folks think. Hmm. And I think that there's been some great work in the last 15, 20 years around business ethics, around different parts of the university coming together and bridging. A lot of that's been reactionary. Mm-hmm. A lot of that's been the result of some of the things that have gone wrong. But I think a lot of it is a more nuanced understanding of the concept of calling and how do you have a meaningful life in doing quality work.
Interesting. And so why do you classify your teaching and research as being on the frontier in terms of asset classes?
Yeah, absolutely. So the course I teach at Emory is called Frontier Investing. And the idea is that there's a common concept of frontier markets. So most people will say there's developed, emerging, and frontier markets. A frontier market, for example, might be like Burma. What I teach is what I call frontier assets. And what frontier assets are those actual investment instruments or vehicles that are not yet, but I think will be or could be, part of institutional portfolios.
Okay.
And those would include things like collectibles, which would be things like wine and art. It would include things like use rights, which would be carbon credits or water use rights. It would include things like reinsurance, but basically different assets that people invest in, and increasingly hedge funds and private equity are investing in, because they're uncorrelated with the broader stock market.
Hmm.
And so what we've seen during the Great Recession is that as diversified as people thought they were, owning German bonds and Dutch stocks and American equities, was that at the end, a lot of that was correlated.
Okay.
And so the quest for this kind of uncorrelated asset class, be it reinsurance or something otherwise, has really been a fascinating thing for me and is what I teach on. But also, to take one more minute on that, I think 10 years ago in business schools, private equity and hedge funds was a kind of very cutting edge topic. Today, those players are such a big part of the market that it's more interesting to ask what's coming after those rather than what a lot of courses focus on, which is let's understand how those players act today. What I try to do in my academic work is say, we can understand where those guys are today by looking at what are the innovative things they're doing at the cutting edge. If it's buying Picassos, if it's making bets about hurricanes in Bermuda, and the whole gauntlet in between.
So is that new, or have people always bet on those type of things?
Well, it's a great question. The word bet is, they haven't necessarily always betted on them or used them as financial instruments. But if you look at timber, for example, which most people would say is one of the newer asset classes, people have been obviously owning and investing in trees since the dawn of private real estate ownership. What you've seen that's so fascinating with something like timber is timber has transitioned from being an asset that was a consumptive asset. We mm-hmm. used it to make wood and build homes and paper, to a financial instrument. Today, most of the timber is owned by Harvard and Stanford and University of Chicago and pension funds. And so you've had people have always invested in timber, but you have now people owning it as a financial instrument.
Interesting.
Another interesting example is the emergence of these new diamond funds. People have been interested in diamonds for a very long time. Mm-hmm. The question is, are people going to invest in them as a purely financial instrument and never see or own or touch the diamond?
So, that's the beauty of Global Leader Radio. Here we have a gentleman that sits across from us that has an interest in religion and violence. He's been educated at Oxford across the pond, and here he is sitting with us here and sharing his insights, not only on leadership, but also on the theories therein. So he has a focus on theory, and he's working in academia, and he also has a focus on the applicability that happens in industry. So, again, it's fascinating to me, but the question I really have to ask for you is, how did you get there? I mean, how do you get where you are from where you started?
Well, I think that if we take the frontier asset investing as an example, I think what's interesting to me and important maybe for your listeners is those people who I've admired and who are doing some of this work on the actual investment frontier are spending real time sitting around thinking about what makes sense to be next. And everyone is so busy and everyone is so caught in the moment that everyone's trying to follow and not be left behind.
Okay.
And so at the hedge fund that I worked at in New York, they used to say a hedge fund is kind of the dumbest investment vehicle. What we really want to do is build a graduate school for risk.
Interesting.
We want to really think deeply about what risks or bets, as we were saying earlier, mm-hmm. are we taking and how are we getting paid to do it. So the way that I've gotten to where I am has been by following those questions and those challenges that are interesting and complex and that I have a passion around. And I've had the fantastic fortune that it's taken me from medieval classrooms in Oxford dealing with, 600-year-old manuscripts. Maybe not with the Dalai Lama quote that you had at the beginning, but to trying to think in the next 60 years, what should Kennesaw State be investing its endowment in, and what should your my 401k be in if we want to really be diversified and build and protect our wealth.
And I like that. So what should our listeners be taking away from your interest in these deep areas?
So on the leadership point, I think it's that by following your passion, all of us work very, very busy days, and it's very hard to stay focused and energized if it's not something that you care very deeply about. And I've always said I'd rather work on something I care deeply about and figure out how to get paid later than something where I get really paid for and have no passion for. So that's one thing at a high level. In terms of in terms of advice, in terms of how people should be thinking, I think that we generally view the world as stagnant and we take a picture of where it is and say, okay, this is right now the best thinking we have around medicine, around we should be 80% stocks, 20% bonds, whatever it is. I think that if people need to act on the best information around investing they have today or medicine or whatever it might be, but be open to the fact that those things are changing and dynamic. And so whether it's how you run your business, you need to run it with the best information you have today, but be open to, as a leader, the fact that that could change and you need to always be educating yourself on what's next and what the most current thinking is.
Yeah, and that's always important, especially when you're looking ahead. So we're spending time with Dr. Mark Bell, the Chief Strategy and Chief Administrative Officer of the Brand Bank. And he was referred to us by our great friend and namesake of the Coles College of Business, Michael J. Coles. And you're listening to Global Leader Radio, the show that focuses on ideas that matter with passionate people who care. And next we'll talk with Kevin Johnson. Kevin is the 33-year-old president of Johnson Media Incorporated, a serial entrepreneur who has over 13 years of experience leading his multimillion-dollar marketing and communications company that services and serves many of the most notable Fortune 100 businesses. He's also the best-selling author of The Entrepreneur Mind, 100 Essential Beliefs, Characteristics, and Habits of Elite Entrepreneurs. And he lives in Atlanta, Georgia with his wife and son. So, Kevin, I don't know if we'll be able to get to all 100, but I want to get to a substantial number here today. And for those people who certainly will not hear it all, we're going to be talking about it on air. And I'm going to get the rest of those 100 before you leave today. So for those people who can't get to all of them, right, we do have that book. So they'll have an ability to get their hands on that book. And I know we'll talk about that as we move through. So it's great to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'm enjoying listening to Dr. Bell, all of his different areas of interest. I kind of see a lot of myself in him. I'm all over the place. And
well, I'd like to be able to do that too. I'm a little older than you, but I still like to be able to see that. So, Kevin, please tell us a little bit about your background, starting with your original birthplace and home, and a bit about your work experience, and take us up to the present.
Sure. I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, but don't hold that against me. I lived there from conception, I guess you could say, until 6 years old. So that's why I can't tell you much. In fact, a lot of people tell me more about Youngstown than I could possibly want to know. Went to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, then moved on to the Boston, Massachusetts area, mm-hmm. and finally to Chicago, Illinois, where I spent my last year in high school. Mm-hmm. Then came to Atlanta on a NASA scholarship here in Atlanta, Georgia, mm-hmm. and I've been here ever since.
Wow.
Yeah, so I started my company as a sophomore in college. The concept of leadership sort of has me thinking of my history a little differently, because I think it played a primary part in who I am today. I started the company not wanting to start a company, if that makes sense. So a friend of mine in SGA, Student Government Association, said, I really want to win this election. I heard you're a really good coder, computer science guy. I've heard you speak about this concept of creating this wonderful website for Atlanta colleges and universities. Can you do it to help me with the campaign? I said, sure. So at that time, it was more of a technical challenge to see if I could build, and this is 1999, if you can remember the time when you have to say, hey, get off the phone. I want to use the internet.
Yeah, that's right. So, and you can actually hear it dialing.
Exactly.
Right?
You can hear that alien type noise. But, you know, I say that because that was the context. 1999, websites were new. I mean, I remember very vividly seeing the first URL or internet address on a Burger King commercial. And I said, wow, it's happening. You know, this internet thing is taking over. So created the website. And my sophomore year, I got a call from a company, JobDirect.com, out of Boston, coincidentally, which was later bought by Korn Ferry. And they said, we've followed your website. We've noticed you get a lot of traffic. How much does it cost to advertise on the website? I had no idea. And please don't take this as a reflection of my poor business ethics. But I hesitated. And if you remember on the old phones, and some of you may still have these phones, you could click mute to give the impression that you're clicking over to the other line.
Right.
So I did that. I said, my mother's on the other line. So I did that to buy some time so I could go to Alta Vista and WebCrawler. Do you remember those?
Yes.
That was
yeah.
before Google. To see how I could price this banner ad.
That was a search engine, right?
Search engine. That's okay. Correct. And so I couldn't find anything. Maybe a minute or two had passed. I said, I've got to click back over. I click back over, and I say $1,800. And you know what he says?
Yeah, we'll
yes.
take it.
The check will be there. We'll FedEx it to you. So I'm a sophomore in college. I have a check on its way for $1,800. And mind you, I felt like I should have kicked myself because I wanted to save $5,000. But as a youngster, I thought, that's way too much money, you know? And I probably would have gotten it. If you remember that era, the dot-com era, people were just throwing money.
No doubt about it.
But sure enough, to make a long story short, the check came, and I couldn't cash it. Because it was in the name of the website.
Oh.
So that's when I learned about this whole entrepreneurship and business thing. I had to go to, at that time it was Wachovia, to get the articles or get my bank account, go get my articles and incorporation, EIN number, all of that stuff. So my story is in large part a part of encompassing of leadership as well as opportunity recognition. So that's how I've sort of gotten to where I am, or how I got started rather.
Well, that makes perfect sense. So take us up to the present. So what are you doing today?
Well, after I graduated in 2001, what I did was I ported that brand to a publication, a magazine, that did really well, became a cash cow, only to have to go back to the internet. So I was way ahead of my time in 99. Huh. So people were buying, but they weren't buying enough. And they said, we'd buy much more if you had a print publication. So I created the print publication. And then in 06, they said, well, we're buying on the internet now.
Wow.
So I shut that down. And so after that, I realized I think the business model that would work best for me would be an advertising agency, because I really love the media space, but I have a short attention span, and I wanted to be in different areas, sort of like the doctor, you know, and there's religion. I want to do it all, right? So the ad agency model allows me to do work for different clients.
Understood.
That have different problems, and the computer science background comes in, because more and more marketing is becoming metric based. Right. So what I did was I took those advertisers and I turned them into clients. So
okay.
We would do the media buying, the ad creative, from the commercials to the radio spots, etc. So I get the best of both worlds. And for me, you know, I hear a lot, and I'll be a bit of a contrarian because that's kind of how the book is. But for me, it wasn't so much following my passion as much as it was following an opportunity.
Okay.
And I think that's what sets a lot of elite entrepreneurs apart, because they'll say, hey, that may not be my passion, but I see there's a huge opportunity to make money there. So I'll expend the resources to maximize that opportunity and maybe exit or sell it, or, you know, just get out of it, but of course maximize that opportunity. And so I've sort of made that transition now as an investor to try and exploit my short attention span and recognize more opportunities that will generate more wealth.
Well, good. Very good. So let's turn our attention to the attention-getting book that you walked in the door with. And in that book, you're talking about 100 key lessons that every entrepreneur must learn in seven areas. And you highlight strategy, education, people, finance, marketing, sales, leadership, and motivation. Did I miss
one?
Very
good.
I got them all?
You got them.
It's fantastic when you write stuff down.
Right.
So lessons include How to Think Big, sure. which is an old David Schwartz book. Who makes the best business partners? What captivates investors? And when to abandon a business idea like you just talked about? What's the exit strategy, right? And when to avoid and where to avoid opening business bank account? And the one I'm very interested in hearing your thoughts on, why too much formal education
I knew that was
can hinder your entrepreneurial growth. What's that all about? You're going to have to start with that one first, my friend.
Sure. Well, you know, it's ironic because the book has been very successful, and a lot of universities and colleges are using it. And it's ironic because I talk about in the book, and I don't want to spoil it, my trip to Harvard Business School. And everyone that I've heard that's been to HBS or sort of kind of talks about it in this, I don't know,
legendary.
Celestial. Yes. That didn't happen to me. I got on campus and I wanted to run. I said, my father encouraged me to go and get that degree. And I'm certainly not knocking it at all. I encourage education, especially when someone else is paying for it. I wanted to cheer when Dr. Bell said that. I said, he gets it. He understands it. For me, it was a challenge trying to justify a lot of debt.
Yeah.
When I was already doing what I love to do,
okay,
and making
money,
a lot of money at it, right? So that was a difficult, difficult is probably not the right word. It was an easy choice at that time, you know, go back to school or continue trying to build the business. And so I that particular part of the book focuses on some statistics that say, you know, if you've got a burning desire to create value and follow a business, go for it.
Okay.
Don't wait.
So that's the essence of why too much formal education can hinder your entrepreneurial growth.
Exactly.
It's opportunity cost, right? It's either one or the other.
Exactly. And you know, I one of the main reasons I wrote the book is to mentor a lot of youngsters. I mean, I started when I was 18, 19, and I want people to avoid the mistakes that I made. And one of the things I run into a lot now is that students are saying, you know, Kevin, I would love to start my business, but I have this letter from Sally Mae, Freddie Mac. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't fund this. I've got to eat.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I try to help.
Well, what do you tell them?
I tell them that's a warranted concern. That's like,
very,
you know,
legitimate.
How do you help someone with that problem? But, you know, I tell them it's not going to be easy. You know, I talk about the Pandoras, for example, 10 years to be profitable. You know, for me, we recently won one of our largest clients, a $40 million contract. It's taken 13 years to get to that point.
Wow.
So, I mean, to me, and I don't want to minimize it, but it's certainly a concern. It's an excuse. It's a good excuse.
Yeah.
Yet it's an excuse.
Right. Because there's so many other ways that you can look to be able to take care of that funding. And certainly when you start with an entrepreneurial mindset, it does help tremendously.
Exactly.
And so certainly entrepreneurial in the sense that you're actually in industry and making things happen, from generating new products and new ideas and new thoughts and kind of going where the opportunities lie. And so a couple of other things I wanted to ask, too. You talk about thinking big. So is thinking big a general problem for entrepreneurs?
I think it is. A lot of the people that I mentor now will have an idea that I think is quite small, and so I encourage them to try and think big or start with a bigger market, especially with the Gen Y population.
Okay.
And these are brilliant students or recently graduated people, and I think a lot of times the energy that you expend on a small idea is equal to or close to that, you know, that you'll expend on a bigger idea.
Yeah.
So I try to help them understand that, so that they want a big outcome, but they have a small approach, and a lot of times it doesn't match up. And so I try to to get them to think big from the beginning. For me, it was a matter of, I mean, my think big moment was when, you know, I created this website, was visited by people outside of the country more than those inside. It's a global audience. People wanted to see the fashion and things of students in this country. And so it became very big and unmanageable. And what I learned was I need to build a content management system around the website so that other people who didn't understand the technologies could administer their website.
Okay.
And so what I was doing, unbeknown to me, in 1999 was basically creating what everyone understands to be is WordPress.
Okay.
So WordPress recently celebrated 10 years in its existence in 2003. We put out OmniPublisher in 1999 and sold it to small newspaper publishers so they could have database-backed websites, which is the cool thing if you had a lot of content. So for me, that was the big moment. You know, before, the smaller idea was the website. The bigger idea, which was later sold, I wish I could have gotten more money for it, but it was sold nevertheless, was to create this platform that organizations, newspapers, nonprofits could use to create their own websites without having to be too technical.
So, Kevin, what do you think, my friend? I mean, that is awesome to note that what we use today with WordPress, we're sitting across from the guy who developed a precursor to that.
That is awesome.
Man.
You can't beat that. Inspirational.
Yeah. Where was I when this was being created? Because I'm not a technical guy, so that exactly. automatically knocks me out. So
exactly.
When you were thinking, when you were talking about this before, you mentioned there were a couple of reasons why, you know, the book was a driver. But so let me go and ask you directly. What motivated you to write that book?
Three things. I had my son.
Okay.
Well, my wife had my son. I was there to help. But, you know, that was a moment when I said, wow, I think my time is going to be devoted to him.
Yeah.
So I wanted to get the book out also to really help people who are experiencing the same things that I had experienced when I was young. I said, there's no reason you should be going through the same things that plenty of entrepreneurs have gone before you. So, and finally, I loved the feedback that I was getting online. I would put up certain segments, and they said, wow, this is great. You should do a book. And you know, being an internet guy, it's like, well, it's online.
You know? online. Exactly. Why do you need a book?
Why do you need a book? But the people that follow me on Twitter and in social media were really encouraging. They said, no, you got to do this because you have a voice. And I think that's why a lot of the universities, ironically, including Harvard, actually use the book.
Wow.
Because it's a very very easy voice to follow.
Okay.
And you get the concepts without having to go too deep into, you know, jargon and things of that sort.
Well, good. So you've touched esoterically at the high level. So now kind of walk our listeners through, because that's why they listen to Global Leader Radio. They want insight first. So the entrepreneur mind, tell us how it's written, who it's written for, and who can expect to get what out of it.
Sure. Well, it's written so that you can read a section every day. I mean, each section is roughly between 500 and 700 words. And that's why a lot of people like it. They can jump around. You know, entrepreneurs or people in business are busy people. So you can go straight to the contents and find something that you think is most relevant to helping you get to where you want to go. I think it's best for those who are just starting out.
Okay.
In business, even though a lot of veterans have really appreciated some of the content that I've shared. I mean, and it's not just my stories. I share stories of Sarah Blakely, Atlanta favorite, who started Spanx. And it's a great person, very accessible. And I'm glad to say I knew her when. haven't been able to get to her lately. But that's understandable.
Don't feel bad. There's probably a lot of people standing in line.
But, you know, they're a little bit for everything, but mostly those, the Gen Ys will really appreciate it. And so, yeah, that's the essence of the book. Again, the voice, people, and I didn't really think it would be received in this way, but people really like the voice. It's an easy read, and even those who aren't interested in business walk away understanding or having a good concept of what cash flow is, or, you know, without necessarily knowing that it's cash flow.
So you talk about the elite entrepreneur. So what is it that makes an entrepreneur elite? Because they would all like to think of themselves as elite, certainly, right, Mark? Wouldn't you think so?
Absolutely. Sure. Well, there's two ways you can look at it. Range based on revenues and how much value you're bringing to the market.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the context is a little bit more psychological. And I've gotten a lot of, I don't want to say pushback, but a lot of people are uncomfortable when they hear certain things in the book, like business comes second, or I'm sorry, family comes second to the business.
Mm-hmm.
I put that one out there. Oh man, I got a lot of pushback on that one,
wow.
But I explained it. And after people read that section, they said, okay, I understand it. And it's more of an indictment of their ability to do what they want if there were a family emergency. I mean,
understood.
Everyone's constricted in some way. So
yes.
Just putting a different perspective out there.
And that doesn't hurt marketing. A little controversy is not
exactly.
A bad thing.
Well, it's funny you mention that because you know a lot of publishers were interested in publishing the book. And I had to stop myself and say, wait a second. I'm an entrepreneur. I want to try and figure this out. And I have a marketing communications firm. So, you know, if I can't get it out, then, you know, perhaps. But I'm glad I did because it's worked out really, really well. But, yeah, a lot of controversy. Choose your spouse wisely. I get a lot of feedback on that.
I love it.
And I think it's more of a subtle testimony than it is pushback.
Kevin, if I could ask, how do you tell entrepreneurs to know if they have a big idea? Because one of the things I have with a lot of my students is they want to do a startup. They want to do Instagram. They want to make $11 billion or whatever the numbers are. And so, you know, and you want to encourage that enthusiasm, but a lot of the ideas are really dumb.
Right.
And so when you say think big, how do you know if it's a good idea?
Sure. And this is that brings up another part of the book that I get a lot of pushback on in saying that the business plan is dead.
Hmm.
You know, I encourage them to get out there and test that idea before you even start writing.
Okay.
You know, and so I'll actually help them test that idea. And there are wonderful websites, especially in the tech industry. That's my background, where you can get out there and test ideas with literally thousands of people, and they will tell you.
Is it good or not good? Wow.
Or whether they would buy it or not. And that's ultimately, or use it. In the tech space, you know, user base is value. But, you know, there are means to test it. And that way you don't have to tell them whether you think it's a good or bad. The market will tell them. And sometimes that's a much better message than any one individual could say. And, you know, I find a lot with Gen Y, and I say this as if I'm not a part of it. I'm on the cusp, Y and X. But I have a lot of youngsters that will say, I want that $1 billion company.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have any idea. You know, they just know that they want $11 billion. They know they got to go to Atlanta Startup Week. They know they have to. And it's kind of sad, unfortunately, because, you know, and I talk about this in the book. You've got to have the right motivation. And the doctor, touched on this.
Yes.
You know, if you're not bringing value to the market, if you're not and I try not to use that word passionate because it's a loaded word. But if you're not driven in a specific industry to get a certain result, and you don't have the right motivation, then it's just empty. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of empty people.
The entitlement factor of the Y generation.
Yeah,
really.
And that's part of it. That's part
it's a
of
lottery
it.
Mentality, kind of. It's kind of I want to get a lottery ticket rather than build something.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah. And that's interesting. And so now you're touching on it in terms of industry. So have you seen that type of mentality in academia when you spend a little time there? Because again, you've gone across a couple of different cultures, and so have you noticed it there too?
No, I think that generally in academia, the view is you have to build a career, which I think the Gen Y has a very different. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone wants to leapfrog and it's a celebrity of the inventor kind of mentality. And so the academy, and this is Oxford much more so than Emory, but you know, you build it chip by chip and you build it up the way I think we thought about businesses in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s before technology gave this explosive ability for good ideas to become instant businesses. And so I think that there's some transition. One thing that we see in the bank that is a real, and I don't know if you touch on it in the book, but one of the things I talk to the Kennesaw State University students that I do talk to is a lot of folks have the entrepreneur's dilemma of they have a great idea, but they have no ability to finance
right.
it. And so the number of folks that we have who come into the bank and say they want a loan and really have no concept of, you know, what banks lend on and how banks work, you know, it's a real yeah. challenge for a lot of people who have great ideas, but don't have any real way to fund them. And I think you bring up a great point, which is there are avenues and ways to get feedback, you know, be it crowdfunding, be it all these different kind of things that have come about. But we do certainly see in the bank, in one sense, people who are kind of undereducated on how traditional financing works, but have great ideas.
No, that's a good point. And I do talk a little bit about that in the book. You know, so many entrepreneurs, and this is Small Business Week, I think it's apropos, use credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great majority of the financing options
wow.
These days. So much so that I saw in the Wall Street Journal that regulations trying to cut back or increase the eyeball, so to speak, on banks and lending to businesses, because it's back up to almost pre-08 levels. That's a good, but if you're a bank, possibly a bad thing. But, you know, credit cards, and the great thing about the technology that the doctor alluded to is that, you know, whereas it may have taken $5 million to start a company, now it may take only $50,000.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you have a lot of free resources, a lot of other options.
The barrier to entry has dropped.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
I do think it's an important and interesting trend that, you know, we had over 10,000 banks. Today we have, you know, closer to 6,000, and a lot of people are saying that's going to go to 3,000. There is a real challenge, I think, for entrepreneurs, not in the high growth tech space, but people who are running operating businesses to get access to local money and credit. And that's one of the things that's been exciting about the work that we've tried to do of running a very small local bank where we try to bank people in the community versus a much larger bank that has kind of a decision that was made in San Francisco or New York, and an Atlanta business is trying to fit into that box. And if they don't, then they're told, you know,
right. we can't help you.
Go fund it on your credit card, which
is,
you know, obviously has its risks. So I think the current administration recognizes the need for small local lenders, but is in a bind because of the need for more regulation. Today at our bank, we have almost more people who deal with the regulation than actually make loans. And so it's a real balance.
Even in terms of the resources that you have to expend.
Real challenge to, you know, for smaller institutions. And that's what drives a lot of the need for these guys to get together, as they say, well, you know, we can share the resources of the guys who are doing the credit and the compliance and all that.
Well, interestingly enough, because it is Small Business Week, and that's nationally, not just locally, correct?
Correct.
Is what is out there today for those who are listening to us and are looking to finance a small business or an idea that can grow into a small business? What resources are out there today so that entrepreneurs understand where to go? Because we know that there's a strata of banks. You've got the very large banks that are nationwide, the big behemoths. You've got the midsize, and then you've got the community banks, and you also have, and I don't know where this falls, but you've also got the credit unions in there too. Mm-hmm. So there's the community piece of it that somehow it needs to be understood a little bit better, perhaps, because they don't advertise as much as the big banks. So how do entrepreneurs know about it, Kevin? I'm looking to you to really be the vanguard and to understand everything there is to know about the entrepreneurial space.
Well, I'll take a few elements because, I mean, there are so many options. One of the awesome things that's been happening lately is the consolidation. Consolidation is probably not the right word, but angel investment firms are starting to do deals together.
Okay.
So
they're consolidating, they're blending.
Well, the word they use now is syndicating deals.
Ah.
So you may have, for example, the Atlanta Angels will reach out to the Savannah Angels, to do a deal.
Okay.
Or they may reach out to the Angels in South Carolina to find more money or to mitigate some of the risk.
Okay.
And that's a very good sign. And they even have platforms online to make the whole process a lot easier.
Interesting.
So whereas the focus when I was trying to get funded was more on VCs, mm-hmm. now all the rage is about angels.
Okay.
Because there are a lot more opportunities, especially in Georgia, helped with the tax credit for angels here. That allows you to get a tax credit if you invest in some of these companies.
So give us the ESPN version between you two gentlemen about what the difference is between those two types of investors. One's VC and one's angel, right?
Sure. Do you want to take a stab?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a venture capital usually will have other people's money and will be trying to invest it in usually a portfolio of investments where they're hoping that one out of 10 makes 100 times and the other 9 are usually losers.
Okay.
An angel usually is investing their own capital. So they're usually more – it's not someone else's money, and they're usually much more focused on – you having a good outcome. And so in a sense, you've brought on a partner. That could be a good thing. That could be a bad thing. But, generally the goals are the same. It's just kind of the nature of the capital is slightly different.
Okay.
And one thing I'll add is when you think about the life cycle of a company, there's that friends and family and angel and very early stage. I really encourage leaders and entrepreneurs, it's at that stage that you really want to be also developing a relationship with a bank.
Okay.
Or because it's when you need money that no one's going to give you money, and it's better to start developing a long relationship so that 3 years into your company, you can go get a bank loan. But, I don't know if there's a preference between venture and angel. It's different. It's slightly different types of capital, but it's very, very high risk capital and early stage.
Okay.
Right. And I think the size of the deals is a noteworthy. You know, the VCs, the behemoths, to use the word you referred to or used earlier. Angels, I know here in the Atlanta area, they can go as small as 25,000-50,000, depending on whether the individual or the group of individuals of angels likes the deal, and they may syndicate or be part of a bigger deal.
If they want to go larger,
they can.
Much larger.
Right. And they probably max out deals I've seen maybe about on the high end 500,000.
Okay.
VCs are in the stratosphere.
Wow.
Right.
Interesting. You're listening to Global Leader Radio, the show that focuses on ideas that matter and discusses that with passionate people. We'll say passionate on this show.
Yes.
Passionate people who care. And so we're spending time with Dr. Mark Bell and also with Kevin Johnson. And so the question I've got for both of you gentlemen, particularly you, Dr. Bell, is I realize you serve on a number of boards and you're involved in many community pursuits, and we touched a little bit on community banks and in that as well. So what advice do you have for our listeners on how to best decide which community opportunities they should be involved in or should give their attention, money, and time to?
Yeah. Absolutely. So not to be too philosophical, but, you know, it goes back to kind of this idea from Immanuel Kant that you have an obligation to do those things where you can have the highest impact.
Mm.
And so if it's playing a small role in a high impact organization or playing a large leadership role in an organization that's growing, I think those are equally important opportunities in that it's really the leader's responsibility to try to determine where she or he can have the highest level of impact. Now, you know, how you measure impact is something that we've always for 2 years I worked in McKinsey's nonprofit consulting division where we charged our full regular fees. It wasn't pro bono work, and we worked with
some of the world's largest nonprofits, and how you measure impact is something they really struggle with. Mm-hmm. Is that number of children read to? Is it number of lives saved? Is it number of people graduating from college? And I think for each person, they have to determine which of those impacts is most important to them. But for myself, be it my opportunity to work with the Carter Center at one end, which is a real leader in global public health, to the other end, where I serve on the Atlanta Advisory Board of a group called MAP, which does a much smaller version of a lot of what the Carter Center does, but does it in a very focused and tactical way. To me, those are two sides of the same coin. So right. It's really around impact and your ability to contribute.
And staying in your personal sweet spot as well, right?
Absolutely.
Because if you're not a finance guy, then you shouldn't perhaps be offering to be a VP of finance with these type of organizations.
Absolutely.
Am I correct?
Right.
Okay. So what are your thoughts, Kevin, when you look at what we're discussing here?
Sure. And I think I learned my approach through the LEAD program, which is the younger version of Leadership Atlanta.
Okay.
And before that program, I would respond to almost anyone who wanted me to serve on the board.
Hmm.
After that program, and they had a wonderful session, I learned to put on the brakes and say, wait a second, how can I best serve? How can I make the biggest impact? Because from personal experience, I knew, and I thought this was the norm, that certain organizations weren't very good for me and vice versa.
Right, right.
And I think at that time, a lot of my colleagues were just trying to get on a board or build a resume. And we learned, no, it's sort of like dating.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to know that you can contribute to an organization. So now when I look at an organization or try to get involved in the community, I try to find organizations that can use what I can bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
Versus me trying to add something to the resume. And that really spoke to me because I was doing my own thing. So it
right.
wasn't so much trying to get something on a resume because I was going to continue doing what I was already doing. So it made it super sense to me because I'd been through a bad experience on a board where I was just underutilized or they didn't utilize me at all.
Okay.
And I said,
okay.
This is not good. So that's always been my approach, try to find organizations that can most use my help.
Okay. Yeah. Well, as I was going through your bio, Dr. Bell, I was fascinated by what we started off talking about earlier. The fact that, you know, you're successful in a series of what seems to be disparate areas. How is that? How are you able to make those happen? Or am I perhaps missing the peg in the middle around which everything else is orbiting?
Well,
he's really smart.
That's the short answer.
It is what it is, right?
I'm good.
Radio good looks. No, I think it, not at all. I think it goes, I think that the peg is really very interesting challenges and problems.
Okay.
When I went to Stanford as an undergrad, I did a lot of work on astronomy. And did a lot of mathematical papers on astronomy, which to me, again, the questions that people are really trying to ask when they're building a business, whether it's a website of what do people want to look at and what do people want to engage with, or whether it's in astronomy or religion, are at the core real fundamental questions about how do we want to live, who do we want to be, all those kind of things, which manifest themselves in what we do every day. When I was
right.
talking earlier about the idea of business as calling. And so I think for me, passion and drive and energy, as we're talking about with the nonprofits, where if you can say to yourself, these are the real things I want to achieve, you know, and this is why I think they're impactful, then I think that that gives you a lot of energy and ability. And I think that being able to convince people over the years that I have athleticism, not in any physical sense, as you guys sitting around the table can tell, but in ability to play a lot of different roles, I think that's been helpful.
Okay, very good. When we first began the conversation, I know, Kevin, you mentioned that one of the things in your book was around what I would call how do you manage life balance and what comes first? Is it family or is it the business? And so they do converge. So somewhere in there, with all the various personal and professional I would say, passions you have and drives that you manifest and you pursue. How does Kevin Johnson manage life balance?
I have a very forgiving wife. It's not anything that I do. It's everything that she does. But, you know, it's funny because, and I guess I'm a bit stubborn in this way. When we were dating, I said, you know, I'd like to date you 4 or 5 years before we actually get married. She says, who says that? That's weird. I said, we actually have to go to premarital counseling before I engage you, because it doesn't make sense after I engage you, because then I'm on the hook,
that's
so to
right.
speak. So she put up with me through all of that time. And I mean, in that time, we shared credit reports. I mean,
yeah.
background checks. It was everything, you know, no surprises. And so,
but you're not a bad bet. I mean, well, we can go. We can let. I mean, the risk there is not high. Come on, Kevin. this is a very smart woman. She
well,
said, wait a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
This vehicle is going places.
Well, you know, we knew each other actually 10 years before that.
And wow.
So, yeah, it was quite intense. But I wanted each of us understand, because she's a reporter anchor, that when we get into this relationship, we know who we're getting in the relationship with. So when it comes down to her possibly getting a new market in the job, I mean, that's what I married,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
When it comes to me having to get the job done and possibly missing something very important, of course, it's take case by case. But in most cases, I've got to get it done, so I'm going to miss it. So I think there's an understanding between both of us that there are going to be some times when the business or the career has to come first.
So, Dr. Bell, it sounds to me like he's screaming flexibility. Was that what it sounds to you?
Yeah, it does. I don't know if my I guess my view is that on the family side, that obviously, as I was trying to say earlier about relationships with students and whatnot, a lot of folks I worked with on Wall Street had a view of kind of a financial scorecard, and that whether they could use the money for anything or not, the money was kind of a measure of who was winning, who was losing. Mm. To me, I think that the relationships, whether it's being mentored by folks or having the opportunity to mentor folks, is one of the ways that I try to keep score for if I'm winning or losing. And for me, with my family relationship, whether it's with my spouse or with my parents or children, I think a partnership approach, maybe not so much with my 5-year-old's partnership approach, but a partnership approach. I have a wife who, like Kevin, is a spouse, is a busy doctor. She runs the emergency room up in Marietta and for pediatric emergencies. And so trying to be flexible with her schedule, which can go from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. or you know, from all different hours of the day, has been a challenge. But I think that comes with the territory, and it's been a fun challenge to have.
And that's the truly the flexibility piece, being able to move about and understanding what each person is looking for out of the whole relationship, correct?
That's right.
Okay. Interesting. As you gentlemen learned earlier in the green room, my role is to get qualified candidates into our executive MBA program. And so I'm sitting across from a guy whose path I am actually pursuing as we speak, in the final stages of pulling my dissertation together to defend it.
Right.
And you've been there. So in your opinion, how does having a degree, and certainly you have yours as well, how does having a degree, and particularly a graduate degree, help us become more attractive, not only potential employers, but to kind of see the world a little bit differently? I guess what I'm asking is, what have you learned from the time before you had that degree? And then as you incrementally have learned, have you learned how to learn better, or is it's something deeper? What would you say?
Well, I would say that having we've gone from a time where having a college degree was a sign of excellence and achievement to now being fairly common, partially through the proliferation of student debt, as we were talking about earlier in the program. But I think that today having a doctorate is such a strong differentiator that from an employer standpoint, it shows that you've been able to focus in a disciplined way on an important area. So whether your dissertation is on
why Protestants kill each other, as mine was, or on an actual applicable area of business, I think it shows a focus and a discipline that people find really valuable. In terms of my own experience, obviously, the academy is kind of the great petri dish for the mind. Wherever, and so to the extent that you can be involved with the academy and get the opportunity to do something that is a long-term engagement with the academy, like doing a doctorate or any kind of advanced degree, you know, it doesn't always show the immediate financial rewards day one. Your salary doesn't double when you come out, but the development you have as a person and trying to become a whole person engaged with the world around you. I think that, you know, there's, I was being facetious earlier, but, you know, staying in the academy as long as possible, I don't think anyone regrets. And I know, right, even though I started my professional career later as a result, it was some of the best time that I spent.
Good answer.
I am. Kevin will say, don't stay in too long. Get out quick.
I'm the antithesis.
I'll grow a business. Well, you know, it was interesting when you and I were chatting when we first met on the phone, telephonically. One of the things that you brought up after you understood, you know, what my role was over at Kennesaw State University was to hail one of our instructors and one of our professors. And so we'd love you to go ahead and hail that again, because he may well be listening.
Well, no, I'm very appreciative of and you're referring to Dr. Herbert,
yes,
who, and I don't remember quite how he found me, but I had the opportunity to speak to his class. He was teaching a class in venture analysis, and I really enjoyed that. So, but I do have some pieces, a couple of pieces of advice.
Mm-hmm.
For those pursuing their MBA or graduate degrees. And I've noticed this recently as we hire people and staff up for the big project.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of this – I think the other Kevin mentioned it, the sort of the air of entitlement. And I think it's more of a younger generation.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get that degree, that MBA, don't focus so much on the MBA as much as – the content or what you've learned,
right,
in that MBA, because you know, with the way the job market is, we get tons and tons of applicants who say, "I've got the paper,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
I've arrived.
Now show me the money.
Show me the money.
Exactly.
Make it rain.
McGuire, right?
Yeah. Make it rain."
So, you know, and you can almost tell immediately that air when it comes in the room, or it even comes across telephonically. Mm-hmm. To use your word earlier. But yeah, that's just the one caution there. And I like what you said earlier. I've learned to learn better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, life is learning, you know. And so if you take that with you throughout life, you'll be okay. Mm-hmm.
I have a quick question, because sure. I'm a big technology buff, and things are going towards more of free online learning. You have Khan Academy, all these different things. I know MIT is involved in a lot of different stuff, and I believe that certification and people actually going through these courses and learning stuff they want to know that's practical to their workplace is going to be the new way people are actually going to get hired, because it's going to be relevant information. And not a degree that compiles a bunch of basic information with some specialized information for $120,000. What do you guys think about that? So,
you know what?
I'll actually take this one first.
Yes. All right. Okay.
because there's more than two options. You described two options. You mm-hmm. described the MOOCs, MOOCs, so it's, you know, massively open online content.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you've also described what happens in a lot of disparate types of organizations and universities mm-hmm. in terms of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. I would dare say that there's a third option where business is screaming at universities to come up with integrated curriculums
like
that help people to understand how to learn, how to think, and how to be agile in their learning. And so when you find that third option, that's kind of the cross between the two. You'll always need, in my mind, the technical aspects.
Mm-hmm.
You'll always need the training. But universities, for me, and what I've seen in being able to work with these graduate students over many years, universities are not there to train you. They're there to help to mold young minds and skulls full of mush and help them to understand how to think. And when you understand how to think by using both continuums, the things that are on the left and the things on the right, then you can stand on your own two feet and make your own choices. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes they won't be good choices because you have to go through the bad decisions to get to making good decisions. But that's part of the process.
Well, yeah, KSU, I believe, is very forward thinking in that. But there are a lot of all those for-profit universities we're seeing out there right now. I do not agree with those whatsoever. They're putting students in multitudes of debt.
Well, the financing of the for-profit colleges is a whole separate thing. But I think that we're kind of all here in agreement. I think what Kevin said is, you know, you can learn a lot about how to run a business by getting out there and running a business.
You got it.
Yeah.
When students come to me and say, I'm thinking about doing an MBA, I've saved up $100,000. It's like, I would rather go see you buy three Domino's pizza franchises and you will learn more about cash flow and running a
Very
business.
True.
Now, but if you want to learn how to think and deal with problems, which the 21st century manager is going to have to do as things change, so rapidly, the ability to integrate information quickly, manage, think about it conceptually and systematically, I think that's what universities that are exceptional teach. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that that's why these degrees make sense and people are getting them. So I think, like we said, it's kind of in between those two.
Yeah.
And there is a blending. And so, Kevin, certainly we want to hear your thoughts on it. But there is a blending to your point, Mark and Kevin, that at certain times in life, in your leadership trajectory, in your career trajectory, you're going to need more training than you need education. But broadly, education, I haven't heard many people tell me that they wish they hadn't gotten an education.
Right.
Not at all.
Right.
So I have to look at it. You look at it on both sides, and typically that's not the case in most other things, but certainly with regard to education, that is the case. Your thoughts?
I'll put it succinctly. So if I'm looking at two resumes that are basically identical, and one says Kennesaw State University, and the other doesn't, I'm going with Kennesaw State University.
And why is that?
It's brand.
Okay.
I think there's a lot of brand equity there, and just knowing the type of people that come out of the program and the curriculum there. You can't get that online.
Okay. So you're saying focus pretty much on entrepreneurship. Is that kind of what you're looking at, or is there broader than that, or what are you thinking when you say brand?
It's broader.
Okay, it's broader.
When you hear certain universities and schools.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Definitely. Because I would dare say that the gentleman to your right would perhaps say that there's another right, university yes. that one should consider if you've got that resume sitting there too.
Well, what's interesting? The largest university represented in our employment pool is Emory. So, I have to gain some credibility back.
Yeah.
So hopefully we'll have some KSU folks come our way.
So, gentlemen, who have you admired that has impacted your leadership style?
So, in terms of people who I admire as tremendous leaders, obviously, for me, MLK would be the largest just in terms of the adversity, bravery, and courage that he demonstrated, but obviously didn't know him personally. In terms of people who I personally know who have been inspirations. Like I said, I've been honored to be able to serve on the board of counselors at the Carter Center. I think Jimmy Carter, as a embodiment of a believing person whose religious beliefs inspire him to work for social justice change and leadership, has been a tremendous influence.
Okay. Kevin?
For me, I keep it pretty simple. I'd say my dad.
Okay.
And even though my father probably doesn't have an entrepreneurial bone in his body. And just now that I'm a father and husband, just realizing what he had to go through. I mean, I was born in 79. You had the oil crisis. I mean, interest rates were through the roof. Then you have savings and loans crisis. I mean, not to say that the recent crises are any less or less severe, but different time. I mean, he worked for the same employer for almost 35 years.
Mm.
And knowing that I can get up and love what I do every morning versus you know, perhaps maybe him not loving it as much as I do and mm-hmm. having to go through that. I mean, that's, to me, that's a leader. I mean, I'm really blessed, but to have to keep a family together and go through all of that, I look at him saying, how did you do it, Mom and Dad? You know, that's lots of respect.
So you're standing on the shoulder of a giant.
Standing on the shoulder of a giant. Two giants.
Two giants. Yeah. And based on that, what's the single most important piece of advice, if you can think of it? And it may be more than one, but I wrote this to say single most important piece of advice you've gotten from your parents.
Oh, I had one ready to go, and then you threw the parents in. I'd say watch your credit. That's probably the biggest one that I can think of. I mean, it's so true. I mean, my father was in credit with Sears mm-hmm. for almost 35 years. And so, yeah, he knew. He said, you know, A1. I remember hearing, you know, that term at the table when I was young. And so, you know, you get to college and you meet other people and they have no idea. I mean, I'm trying to convince them to get their free credit report or what have you. And they're like, what is that?
Yeah, you know, credit's a foreign term.
It's a foreign term, and it makes such a difference. And next to a banker. So, yeah. You know? But, I mean, it makes a big, big difference.
Well, and you provided a perfect segue because certainly Mark gives advice quite a bit to folks and entrepreneurs and helping them to take their ideas from concept to reality. So, Mark, what's the single or a couple of the best pieces of advice you've ever been given?
Well, I think honestly, I can answer both Kevin. You know, I think that my parents gave me a piece of advice, which I would give to people who are trying to build businesses, which is that relationships really matter. And that in a high tech world, we also need high touch. And that people who believe in you and know you and have seen that you have a proven track record, we call it the Goldberg effect, which is a little deli here where if you're going to see that guy every day in the deli, the probability he's going to pay you back or the probability that he's going to do what he says is much higher than if you're sitting 3,000 miles away. And so despite how systematized and securitized and industrialized and technology our world has become, I think that relationships are still what moves a lot of businesses forward, and developing those relationships, being someone who's trustworthy, is something that's really important to advancing businesses, and something that my parents, whether intentionally or subliminally, kind of instilled in me as well.
Very good. What are you both doing to ensure that you continue to grow and develop as leaders?
I'm always reading. A good friend of mine just published a book, Dr. Dennis Kimbrough, and he talks often about how elite entrepreneurs read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him recently at a conference, and it was interesting because someone made a reference to cable, and I said, I haven't had cable in 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And they started laughing, and then Dr. Kimbrough said, no. That's consistent. Do you read? I'm like, yes, I read. So I try to read. I mean, the more I read, the more I make. It's a strange correlation.
The more I read, the more I make. And yeah. That needs to be a takeaway. I like that. Thank you for your response.
Sure.
Mark?
I think that for me, one of the things that I'm doing is trying to, one, stay ahead of my students, whether they be at be at Emory or be the ones that I get to work with at KSU who have a ton of experience, have a ton of specific questions, and I think that's really good. And then the other is, as we talked about at the top of the show, trying to think and be really thoughtful about what's coming next rather than just being reactive, trying to be proactive in some of my thinking at the bank.
Very good. So, gentlemen, we come to that time of our conversation where you look up and time has really flown by. And knowing that you both had very busy schedules and greatly appreciating the fact that you took time out of your schedule to be with us today, I'm going to ask you the second to last question I'll ask today. So which book has most impacted your leadership ability?
I'd say the Bible, no doubt about it. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would say the most influential book I've yet to read would be The Entrepreneurial Mind by Kevin Johnson.
But I like those, this guy.
I think it's Voltaire who said, in our age, owning a book has replaced reading it. And I know I'm guilty of that on several fronts. But in terms of books that I've actually read, I think I referred to a couple times. There's a book by Novak called Business is Calling, which for me really helps integrate these ideas of a meaningful called life in the business life.
Awesome. Very good. So, Kevin and Mark, on behalf of our learning community, again, I truly appreciate you for accepting our invitation to join today. And I'd love to have you back on the show sometime where we can work out our schedule. So, would that be a deal?
Sure. It sounds great.
Well, we'd good. Well, with that in mind, I will ask you the last question I'm going to ask you today. Can you tell us how our learning community can contact you by email and or by phone?
Sure. You can contact me via email. That address is Kevin. Kevin at johnsonmedia.com. Again, that's Kevin at johnsonmedia.com, and you can find information about the book, The Entrepreneur Mind, and would love to sign a copy for you so you can read and learn from my mistakes and the others of greats.
And I have a long one, but I'm at M as in Mark Bell, B-E-L-L, at Brand Group Holdings with an S.com. And then I'm at 404-326-0737, and would love to hear from folks who are interested in some of the topics we talked about today.
Yeah, and continuing that conversation too, right? It has been an extremely stimulating and fascinating conversation too. I thank you both for that. And additionally, as a special thank you for appearing on the show, I've got a copy of Business Acumen 2, nice. And that's insights from the faculty and friends of the Coles College of Business. I don't actually I haven't signed it, but if you want me to, I can. I didn't write anything in it. Just want to make sure that disclaimer is there. So with those smiles, we'll bring today's edition of Global Leader Radio to a close. And we invite all our listeners to check our web presence for previous interviews and links to valuable leadership resources. And also, please drop me an email at acm0996@kennesaw.edu if you have recommendations for guests. And actually, both of you have been recommended, of course, in the studio here in the ether. That's probably why we do it in radio, because I have a face made for radio. To Kevin's left, the person that recommended him is actually in studio with us, Monique LaRue Wilson. And we said it several times, of course. Michael J. Coles is the one that referred Mark Bell. So obviously, these recommendations for guests have really worked out very well. And for those of you who are interested in our award-winning Executive MBA program, please go to the EMBA icon on our Global Leader Radio website and connect with us and sign up for an information session. And Julie Miller, our recruiter, would want me to tell you that we've got two set for the July timeframe, so two Saturdays that you can come and visit with us and get a 360-degree view of our program. So join us again at the same location for the next edition of Global Leader Radio, the show that discusses ideas that matter with people who care. So have a great week.
Global Leader Radio is brought to you by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University. Take charge of your personal development and professional career today by learning more at KSUEMBA.com. And join us next week as we discuss ideas that matter with people who care. We'll be right back.